Homeopathy relies on biological intelligence, a subject about which we seem to be stumbling around in the dark still. And in some respects, we have no excuse, since our original hospitals were based on homeopathic remedies, and successfully so. This was especially true in what was very sane and moral care of the mentally ill. Jerry Cantor, faculty member of the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine, shares this and more in his appropriately titled book, Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind. This is Robin with Tributaries. Jerry, before we speak about your latest book, I'd like to hear a bit about your personal place in medical history, being the first acupuncturist to receive an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School's Department of Anesthesiology. What year was that when the door opened, and what did you experience or see since that time?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to make too big a deal out of it, quite frankly, because, okay, so that was 1999, April Fool's Day, and I believe I was a token appointment, quite frankly, because from the standpoint of integrative medicine, I definitely think they wanted to have me on there. I was appointed to a staff position in the pain unit of the Brigham Hospital, and when they do that, then they have to put you on the faculty of the medical school, so I did appreciate that very much. But the idea of actually trying to figure out what's the best thing for a patient, if it's acupuncture or something else, that didn't happen. Basically, they just went along their normal way. But there was really no attempt to do any kind of what I would call a genuine integration. It's a profit-driven thing. It was still a wonderful experience. I was on there for 15, 20 years before I left. My approach to pain and the clinic's approach to pain are two very, very different things.
Thank you for clarifying that. And it's not a surprise, right?
No, not in retrospect. They showed me a case of thoracic outlet syndrome, which did not look like a very serious thing, something I could have treated with acupuncture in 3 or 4 visits, and they were intent on taking the person's rib out. I thought it was an April Fool's joke, to tell you the truth. But that's the kind of place, and I don't believe that pain is a disease, frankly. It's a signal.
I loved the way that you wrote in your book, Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind, and I quote, "For a quarter of a century throughout the United States, alternate and well-traveled routes for humane and effective psychiatric care existed." And you are referring, of course, to homeopathy, and it's amazing how quickly those paths can be covered up. And I'm sure our audience knows about homeopathy in general, but can you share its premise in regard to mental health?
Oh, boy, this is really a book-length topic, because the madness that I was writing about from 1875 to 1920 is very different from what we have today. But homeopathy is phenomenal for psychological issues. It's probably the most psychological kind of medicine there is. When you give a remedy, even for a physical complaint, if you're doing working constitutionally, you have to find out what the origin of that is in the person's life history or consciousness. So we go very, very deep into someone's background, regardless of what they come to us with. It's only with over-the-counter stuff that you would prescribe based on one symptom alone. What I love doing is constitutional homeopathy and finding out what the meaning of this symptom is to interpret it. And that involves going quite deeply into the person's history. One of my favorite questions to ask is, what's your hot button? What situation do you get into that will provoke an emotional response from you? If I saw you really bent out of shape, what would I see? Would you be crying? Would you be irritable? Would you be withdrawing? Would you write a poem? Would you have a drink? What would trigger that? What situation would trigger that? Because how we become uncomfortable has a great deal to do with how we develop symptoms. And the symptoms themselves are fantastic clues as to what's going on in their specificity. So homeopaths love very strange, unusual symptoms, because these are doorways into what the body is trying to tell us. I have an adage that says acute illness detoxifies, but chronic illness informs. So this is exactly the opposite of the prevailing paradigm, I suppose, where we're all terrified of acute illness and we accommodate chronic illness with all our medications. But to homeopaths, it's exactly the opposite. If you're going to survive an acute illness, if it could be COVID, if it could be anything, that's better than covering it up, suppressing your symptoms. And conversely, chronic illness thing where you have good days and bad days. It comes in and goes out. That's not normal. That problem should be brought to a head. And a homeopathic remedy can do that, figuring out what is going on. What's the existential issue there? There's going to be a homeopathic remedy that actually matches that issue. And so taking the remedy is like allowing yourself to have a little bomb placed deep in your subconscious that blows up and then changes the landscape there. And then you get a shift in your issue.
Yes, I like hearing that. That's a great description. You just mentioned, however, the mental illness was very different in those years. And how so?
Oh, my goodness. Well, basically, psychiatric medications have produced this onslaught of mental illness in our country. Read Robert Whitaker's books, Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic. He just eviscerates the psychiatric and psychopharm community on their own evidence. Completely on their own evidence. It's not even ideological the way, you know, Thomas Szasz attacks psychiatry. They never used to be anything like tardive dyskinesia. This is all from the medications that we have. We did a homeopathic proving of haloperidol, which is a major schizophrenia drug. The homeopathic version treats what that drug actually is supposed to treat, all the conditions that it causes. Let me go back to Civil War era. In that time, madness was very, very different, and much of it had its roots in syphilis or inebriation. This drunkenness was a huge problem in this country, chronic drunkenness, but also the grief from the Civil War. The carnage of that war was tremendous, and it blew up people's ideas about death, and the grieving process could not handle it. You know, I learned about my study that time, people's last words were very, very important to the survivors, what their life meant. And there was also this idea that the body would be resurrected, odd as it might sound to us today. That idea was blown apart because people's Civil War casualties resulted in bodies being destroyed beyond recognition or not identified, not found. It was so horrible that there weren't any mollifying last words to be found. So the country kind of went crazy. And this is when all these mental hospitals exploded all around the country. Dorothea Dix had something to do with that because she noticed that the conditions were really terrible for the mentally ill. And so under her influence, the mental hospitals proliferated around the country. But 10% of them were homeopathic.
Yes.
And this is where my book comes in, because the homeopathic hospitals, and this is the history that's been buried and censored, were utopias. They were self-sufficient farms. They offered all kinds of cultural and physical opportunities. The nurses were spectacular, or they really had you grapple with your illness. Clara Barris was this genius nurse educator that I wrote about. She was at the Middletown Hospital for 14 years with Sheldon Talcott there. And she wrote this amazing holistic book called Nursing the Insane in 1908, and that's a masterpiece. People grappled with mental illness through the idea of moral hygiene. They didn't just drug you and send you back into the community. You could stay in that asylum for quite some time till you got your wits back. People rode in the same direction, really trying to help you. The nursing, as I said, was a big part of it. The homeopathy was a big part of it. Baseball therapy was a big part of it, believe it or not, as practiced at the Middletown Hospital. It's just an extraordinary story.
Yes.
And it's such a shame that this has been censored.
Yes, I appreciate that you bring this all up in your book. And what you were just talking about brought me into two thoughts. One was, really was an opportunity for people to take part, not just be separated. And that's not unlike the Steiner School. My daughter worked at a Steiner School for the handicapped young adults, and it was on this lovely farm, and they had gardens and cows and art and all these things to really help someone be a full person. And the other thing that reminds me, in reading a new book that just came out by Stephen Buhner called Earth Grief, he talks about soldiers and what we now know as PTSD, which has been just numbed down really into four letters. In the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. And it just speaks such a different language, doesn't it? It really tells a different story.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everything was different. The lingo for mental illness was different.
Mental illness in one culture may be valued behavior in another, and so societal beliefs, whether the societal beliefs are the chicken or the egg, play into the story. And what do you see as a generally held belief that is then treated differently with homeopathy?
You know, you cannot pin madness down. It's impossible. In certain cultures, it's absolutely commendable. It's necessary. It's wonderful. Other times, it's not so much like that. In the beginning of my book, I have actually seven categories of mental illness based on history. Have been looked at, mentally ill. They've been looked at as beasts. They've been looked at as defective, as tortured souls, as troublemakers, sinners, as diseased, as possessed. All of these things play into the culture. It's very, very difficult to pin down. The idea of giving it a medical diagnosis is not a good idea. Then you've created this stigma that you have to detach yourself from. Much better would be to talk about it as a problem of life, the way Thomas Szasz did. I did something else in the book, which is very low key, but I came up with a common sense idea about how one becomes mad. There are basically three conditions that will produce it. One is exhaustion, one is fear, and the other is the narrowing of one's bias. Each of these things are within the realm of what's one normal experience. But the conjunction of a flight, exhaustion, and the narrowing of one's existing bias will produce a situation which you can call psychosis, where people look like they have this broken from reality. It's not entirely a breakage. And if people are supported in the various ways that were done in these what I call sane asylums, or in the community of Giel in Belgium, which had a model of foster care, you put up with it, you give support to it, you don't battle it, you don't try to suppress it. People eventually, much of the time, regain their wherewithal. They become functional in some sort of way. Or their madness may be put to good use.
Right. You've already mentioned Middletown Hospital. They really had the goods, as you write about in your book. And tell us a piece of their history with a story. And we could say that they were 100 years ahead of their time, but it seems to me that they were running on a parallel time in another mindset.
Ooh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, I do have the fantasy that this kind of place would come back. You know, it was the mother church. It was run so well. It succeeded in so many ways under Selden Talcott, who the book is dedicated to. All these other physicians came through there. They had apprenticeships there, so to speak. And then they started their own asylums. It was the mother church. That's the way I would talk about it. It had 47 buildings. It held like 2,000 to 5,000 patients. Its ultimate failure had to do with its success. Places were not meant to have so many clients. It's impossible to render that kind of care with so many people. I like the quote I came up with for the beginning of that chapter from Oscar Wilde. A map of the world that does not include utopia is not worth even a glance, for it leaves out the one country in which humanity is always landing. And when humanity lands there, it looks out, and seeing yet a better country, sets sail. Progress is the realization of utopias. And that's from The Soul of Man Under Socialism. So these people, they burned with a utopian fervor. Selden Talcott was one of those. He was a Civil War physician, a tremendously smart guy, a great disciple of Samuel Hahnemann, and very observant. Just the fact that he noticed how perked up the mental health clients were, the patients were, when they watched the baseball game. He really went with that. He created a fantastic team there called the Asylums. And this is how I came to go down this rabbit hole. I just was so fascinated by the story of that baseball team. Initially, inmates and staff members were playing baseball together on the field and enjoying that. Other people watching that inspired him to create this fantastic team. They played major league teams on an equal level, and everybody loved them. What's really funny, by way of contrast, upstate from there in Utica was another hospital, which also tried to practice moral care, which was a matter of not being tremendously abusive to clients. Under its superintendent, they had a restraining device called the Utica crib, which was horrendous. It was a little tiger cage, which they used to restrain patients and break their will and punish them. They used to lock you into this thing. It was absolutely notorious. Another baseball team in the minor leagues that was created in Utica, in a sort of a nod to that situation, called itself the Pent-Ups. The other thing is, it occurred to me that the expression to become unhinged, I don't know if this is true or not, but I suspect it came from that Utica crib, because when people were unhinged, when you unhinged the cover of it and let the person out, they were twice as crazy as before.
No doubt.
Yeah. I dug into the medical records of the Middletown Hospital to find out how the clients were treated homeopathically, and I did find a number of records. But they did rely on the homeopathy, but also on the fact of the passage of time and the care of these fantastic nurses and playing musical instruments and farming and doing artistry and being encouraged to write letters and just being in a beautiful surroundings of Middletown. This was a utopia, and believe it or not, the hospital was actually self-sustaining under the wonderful directorship of Selden Talcott.
His being the greatest psychiatrist not known according to you, is founded on some very solid, solid ground, isn't it?
He was very well regarded. When President Garfield was assassinated, Selden Talcott and another homeopath, Samuel Worcester, were called as expert witnesses to evaluate the state, mental state of the assassin. At first, they were called for the defense, saying, well, these guys, they're clearly going to say that he's crazy, and that will get this guy off the hook. But that wasn't the case. Talcott and Worcester had a lot of integrity, and they said, no, he's not crazy. He just had an agenda. And so they wind up having to switch sides, and he wound up testifying for the prosecution. But then it really enhanced his credibility. These were very formidable, very, very fine people. They did believe that ultimately it would be an organic cause found for mental illness. They believed that as scientists. In fact, whether or not that turned out to be true, it, in my opinion, it mainly did not come out to be true. It's very, very difficult to find an organic correlate to mental illness. They would continue practicing in accordance with classical Hahnemannian homeopathic principles, which is to use the totality of symptoms to help somebody. In other words, you didn't go fishing for some chemical imbalance or something like that, which is a complete fraud, and then warp people's body chemistry for this in order to effect some kind of a terrible change. No, they didn't. They kept to the homeopathic agenda, even though they believed that there would be a scientific reason that would uncover the cause of mental illness.
Jerry, you mentioned that you were able to see some of the old medical records from Middletown Hospital, and I'm wondering, considering the medicines that were used, have you used them yourself and you concur and say, of course they use that, and perhaps you can share one of those homeopathic remedies that you have used and seen good results with regarding mental health?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm familiar with all the remedies that were used. I've used every one of them in my own practice. They practice somewhat the way I do, in which once a remedy acts, I change it because the person changes in accordance with that prescription. They didn't have all that much time to spend with each person. They would go and evaluate the client and give a remedy for their immediate state and move on like that. I don't think they were looking for one remedy cures at that time, the way we can in our practice now. And I don't have anybody who is so far gone. It would be unusual to get somebody who's so far gone that they really cannot function at all in life. But, you know, let me tell you maybe the case I have that I conclude the book with. I don't know if you've got to see the case of the naked schoolgirl.
Yes, but my listeners obviously haven't. So
that's an amazing example of homeopathy. That girl could very easily have been...
Why don't you share that story then?
Institutionalized or something like that. The one who took all her clothes off. And I did find a remedy that matched her situation, which was not obvious. But all the remedies that I saw there in those records, yeah, they're commonly given. They're commonly given. But as I say, I don't have anybody who's exactly crazy the way people were in the late 1800s, 1900s. But there are very strong similarities.
Of course, yes. Yeah. Are there any homeopathic remedies that have kind of fallen out of favor, or are they all still as popular and used in this day, considering it was developed such a long time ago? Or are there remedies that have come up since the original homeopathy was first started?
Yeah, both things. I have a book somewhere of olden discarded remedies. They're still just as good, but they sort of fall out of fashion.
Right.
Other remedies become kind of go into fashion. And for sure, in our time, because there's so much toxicity, whole entirely new classes of remedies have come up that have to be used. You know, remedies made from the emanations from our technology, for example.
Mm.
Those have come up. There's an amazing remedy called Berlin Wall.
Wow.
It certainly didn't exist way back then. This feeling of walls, feeling being deprived of social contact. Boy, new ones. We have a remedy made from positronium that has come up. Back then, when there was less of a difference between allopathic prescribing, conventional medicine prescribing, and homeopathic prescribing, the homeopathic remedies were made from the medicines, the same medicine, just far, far more dilute. So there was a lot of overlap.
Mm-hmm.
I refer to a physician by the name of David Dice Brown, who wrote a book on the permeation of modern-day medicine by homeopathy. And he basically called a timeout because people were saying, constantly reinventing homeopathy, think they'd done something brilliant by accidentally giving too dilute a prescription or something and thinking that they'd come up with something brilliant. And they were just reinventing what Hahnemann had been writing about for 80 years already.
Yes.
So the battles were political then, just as they are now.
Yes.
Everybody was using the same stuff. This is before the Flexner Report, before the pharmaceutical medicines came up that were byproducts of the petrol industry.
Right.
And that you could patent.
Yes.
So people were using the same things. There was much more of a sense of communality. In my story about Mary Todd Lincoln, I pretty much proved that she was cured by homeopathy. The physician who treated her did not acknowledge what he was doing. He never kept records. She was referred to him by a bunch of homeopaths, the old guy, wink, wink, you can take care of her. He had a great reputation. And yeah, he cured her in about 3 months using the remedies of that time, basically detoxing her from chloral hydrate.
Mm.
That's what I think happened to her.
Yes.
But the overlap was really great. As I say, it was a winking relationship. He couldn't come out officially as a homeopath. He couldn't do that.
Right.
There was no other way he could have helped her like that.
Right.
He just with moral care, which was a matter of being respectful to clients and handholding.
Yes. Now, did you interview or speak to mainstream psychiatrists for this book?
Mainstream psychiatrists? I have a couple of psychiatrist friends who are also homeopaths. Eric Leskowitz is a psychiatrist who wrote the foreword for my book. It's an absolutely wonderful foreword. He's a holistic psychiatrist, and he completely gets this. I'm very pleased to have that in my book. Honestly, conventional psychiatrists, that would be such a head-butting experience. I cannot imagine it, frankly. You know, there's a gigantic gap between people who are invested, who are conventional psychiatrists, and homeopaths. It's not really bridgeable.
Yes, yes.
They're wedded to these diagnoses. They're wedded to their pharmaceutical use. They think they can just give the right cocktail, they'll get you going. But as Robert Whitaker shows, psychiatry in this country has been a disaster. Our mental health statistics are worse than that of developing countries, much worse.
Yes.
Because of the pharmaceutical use.
Right. I know many people who just can't even. Perhaps they've tried some medication, but then they have to get off it because they can't take it. What is the takeaway from sane asylums that you're hoping for?
Oh, there's quite a few, but the most basic one is, my God, look, you can fight homeopathy on idealistic grounds and scientific grounds, but please don't oppose it on historical grounds. This actually all did happen. It really did. Take a look at these photographs. Look at the records. Don't oppose me on history, okay? This is not the Soviet Union where you can just pretend something never happened, because you prefer it never to have happened. This really did happen, and let's look at it and take it seriously and see how tragically that turned out for all of us. That's
yes.
The main one. The second one, of course, is that homeopathy, I'm going to speak in strong terms here. I'm the son of Holocaust survivors, so I don't say this easily. There are a couple of great denials in our world. One is that the Holocaust never happened. Another one is that climate change is a hoax. And the third one I would put right up there is that homeopathy doesn't work, that homeopathy is not one of the most powerful and most brilliant medicines that have ever been created. That kind of denial drives me nuts. And there's so much evidence. You know, you can tell a big lie more easily than a small one somehow. And so that's what I'm trying to have happen. It was very, very hard to get this book into print, frankly. I could have published it myself, but I was quite determined to have a mainstream publisher produce it so it gets into libraries. The three major publishing houses in the world that publish homeopathic and medical texts together, Team, Springer, and Elsevier, have succumbed to the kibosh. They will not publish homeopathy books anymore. And so I had to make the argument really strenuously that, you know, this book will sell, don't worry, it will sell, even though it has homeopathy in the title, because it addresses the reasons for the kibosh, why homeopathy has been marginalized. And I think a lot of people are going to be very unhappy that this book came out, because they have done such a, you know, consciously or unconsciously, people censor themselves when they find that something is not supposed to be talked about. You can go and check this out. History of medicine in this country, they will mischaracterize homeopathy as being a sect or being a heresy. These books are not written by homeopaths, but they're, you know, people who have a lot to gain from the promotion of this idea.
Yes, yes.
Or look at the history of research, the history of mental health in this country. Mental hospitals, these places are not mentioned. That's astounding to me. They were enormous. They were huge, and they were very, very popular. to disgrace that they were simply, the mention of them was scrubbed from these books. So that's the takeaway. I want people to say, look, this happens. Let's deal with it. You know, look at the websites of these hundreds of hospitals that were originally homeopathic, medical schools that were homeopathic, where that mention has been scrubbed away. That's disgraceful. That should not happen. Should not happen in the United States. Shouldn't happen anywhere. And I hope this book has a breakthrough into the mainstream. I hope many other books follow it. It was a difficult book to write, a lot of fun, but I felt I should have been a team of people. It's too much information for one person to have to deal with. And I want other people to jump into this.
Right. And the subtitle to your book, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind. Jerry, I think most of us are looking for sane asylums these days. And I'm wondering, where is yours? Where do you go for some respite or peace?
Oh, yeah. I don't get enough of that. I love to swim. I like to go to the mountains. So I hope I don't need an asylum, sane or insane, at any point. I think these places should come back. I think people absolutely do need asylums, places where they get peace, where they're allowed to work something out for themselves, where they're supported by people who have like mindsets. There's clearly a need for that.
Right, and that's what I mean.
Putting people on drugs and getting them into the community where they can be barely functional and suffering, standing and shaking with tardive dyskinesia, that's not my idea of a great mental health.
No, and I was referring to just anywhere can be our asylum. We don't need to go to a place.
A meditation posture, that would
exactly be
a vacation for me.
Yes.
When I get the chance to meditate for 40 minutes.
Right.
In absolute peace and quiet. Or take a hike in the woods. Bathing in the forest. Forest bathing, Japanese call that. Yeah, we have nature. Everything plays into it. We need to regain the world in its pristine form.
Right.
And come to peace with it. And also accept the reality of illness. You know, it is information. If we're acutely ill, something we're being told that we're either stressing ourselves or something's going on with us. If we're chronically ill, it means we're not dealing with something at a deep level.
Right. Well said.
These things are worth dealing with, worth sitting with, worth investigating. It's not worth our while. It's not a good thing to just kind of push them aside so that we can go back to a high-paying job.
Jerry Cantor, whose book, Sane Asylums, is hopefully bringing back some more sanity to all of our medical care. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are where you like to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.